ज्ञानतिमिरन्धस्य ज्ञानञ्जनशलाकया चाक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः वञ्चाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः नमो महाबुधाञ्जाय कृष्णप्रेमप्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्णचैतन्यानं निगूढद्विषे नमः हे कृष्णा करुणासिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेशा गोपिकाकान्तराधाकान्तनमोऽस्तुते तप्ता कञ्चन गौरङ्गे राधे वृन्दवनेश्वरि वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैता गदाधर श्रीवासदि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे हे सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय श्री गौर निताय की जय श्री राधा
किशोर किशोर
किशोर किशोर की जय गौड़ वैष्णव गुरु परंपरा की जय साधु संघ की जय गौर प्रेमानंद हरि बोल तो गुड आफ्टरनून टू ऑल ऑफ यू और गुड मॉर्निंग हाउ यू से 11:38
गुड मॉर्निंग
गुड मॉर्निंग टू ऑल ऑफ यू वेलकम सो वी आर कंटिन्यूइंग विद सम शेयरिंग एंड रिफ्लेक्शन दैट वी स्टार्टेड यस्टरडे इन द मॉर्निंग टॉकिंग अ लिटिल बिट अबाउट सम थीम्स दैट been trying to explore in a recent book published Evolution and Divine Love. I have here a copy I'd like to share a few sections from it, in which basically I try to explore, as the subtitle says, the eternal becoming of God, soul, and matter. So how can we think in God as becoming, like in a becoming, not only that God is, but God also becomes. Krishna is Krishna, but Krishna also becomes more Krishna. Because Krishna means the all-attractive. The scripture said, at every moment, Krishna becomes more attractive. So if Krishna is the all-attractive and Krishna becomes more attractive, means Krishna becomes more Krishna, right? The all-attractive becomes even more attractive. So how can we think about this, about the God changing, in certain way changing, in certain way not changing? That's a bit equation of our tradition, one and different, unchanging and changing, unchanging and changing, right? Because Krishna is always Krishna, God is always God, as we were talking yesterday. It's not that someone else takes a post and becomes a new god, and the old god is dethroned. But at the same time, that supreme personality of Godhead continues to become more beautiful, continues to experience newer depths of love. So we can talk about God as changeless, but also we can talk about God as ever new, ever fresh. So that's the paradox, this apparently contradictory qualities in the divine. In Christian mysticism, they will use this Latin expression, coincidentia oppositorum, which means God is the coincidence of opposites. Now, what we feel as opposites, in God, there is a coincidence, a reconciliation. So there is no opposites, actually. There's no duality. There's no inner conflict or clashing in the divine. But there is paradox. God is paradox. And paradox means a different way of thinking about things. Paradoxical thinking means thinking in ways that can accommodate things that otherwise will seem contradictory. Again, achinta bit a bit, that's paradoxical. No? One and different. No? One and many and one. Generally, we think one or different, the same or different. Many or one. No, both. Plus. Not either or, but both and. That's achintya. Achintya means paradoxical. Paradoxical doesn't mean you cannot understand it. It means you can only understand it thinking in a different way. No, classical example sometimes given by our acharyas, the sun. Sun is a representative for the divine in many ways. It is even said, very interestingly, sometimes you may have heard the expression Surya Narayan. Sometimes it's said that we have heard that recently I was hearing from Bhakti Vigyan Bharati Maharaj. He's a renowned Vaishnava scholar, disciple of Bhakti Dayita Madhava Maharaj. And he will quote Shastra to show that at the time of Brahma Muhurta, the sun is none different from Narayan. So if you have darshan of the sun at that time, it's like having darshan of God himself. And that's why Brahma Muhurta is so special time of the day. If you have darshan of the sun at that time, it's like none different from the divine. In other times of the day, still it's a symbol and reminder, but there a special directness tied between God and the sun at that particular time. So I'm saying all this because the sun many and Krishna himself sometimes called, I don't know, Krishna Surya Sam Maya Andhakar Dahan Krishna Tahan Nahi Maya Radhika. Krishna is like the sun that once when it comes dispels darkness, ignorance, and so on. So we, given the example of the sun, we can say, okay, the sun has entered the room now. Yes, we see. We can see because if there will be no sun, we wouldn't see each other now. There are no electric lights here. It's just the light of the sun. So the sun entered the room. Agree? But the sun has not entered the room. The sun. Agree? What do you mean? Are you crazy? You agree with both things? No, you're not crazy. You just embrace paradox. The sun enter in the form of a ray of the sun here in the room, but the sun personify the whole planet sun. If the sun enters here, the room is over, the town is over, we are over. So it entered and it did not enter. That's paradoxical thinking again. Because usually we think, no, it entered or it did not enter. No, it entered and it did not enter. And this principle is all over creation, all over reality. That's like the template for reality, bhed abhed. Stay enough with difference, but also stay enough with non-difference. Reality is one and different. But sit enough with both. No? Sometimes we run from one to the other. No? There is a place to say everything is Krishna from the abhed perspective, non-different. But many times we quickly go, no, but everything is different. I'm not Krishna. The world is not Krishna. Yeah, that's the bad perspective. Sometimes we are too much into the bad perspective of difference, difference, difference. That we need to stay in the everything is Krishna. Everything is connected, inseparable from Krishna. Stay there enough time. So when we see difference, we see the difference in interconnection, in interrelatedness. So we are different. I'm not you. You are not me, but we are not entirely different. We are not entirely separated. We are not absolutely isolated being from one another. So we are different and non-different. Veda. So this applies to Krishna himself. He is changeless and he is ever-evolving. Stay with that for a moment. Yeah, it's unsettling. The mind wants to go to one or the other, no? Hold space for both. Paradox. Paradox holds the most truth. If you just pick one or the other, you're having half of the cake, so to say. Partial picture of reality. And this is not my own creation again. This is present in Shastra. Srila Rupa Goswami, when he gives 64 qualities of Krishna as an attempt to summarize Let's say something about God in 64 qualities. It's not that he's limited to 64 qualities. And one quality is he's changeless. No, Krishna is always Krishna. God is always God. He's love. He's always love. He's changeless in so many ways. But two qualities after that, he says Nitya Nutana. Krishna is ever fresh. Right after saying he's changeless, like trying to make that point. Krishna is changeless. Two qualities after he's ever fresh. Yes. Sanatana Goswami says something similar. Let's see if I find the verse without making you wait too much. Sanatana Goswami says, literally. Although the Supreme Lord is always one and unchanging, at every moment, he brings forth hundreds of newer and newer varieties of transcendental charm. Both in himself and in his love, he does this by his potencies inconceivable to everyone else. So there you have the whole Achintya Bheda Bheda in question. So he's one and unchanging, yet he's always bringing forth newer and newer expressions of love. So both are brought into the picture. We cannot just take one or the other. That will be what Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami calls Ardha Kukutti Nyaya, the half-hand logic. You may have heard about this, Chaitanya Charitamrita, when the brother of Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami really liked Mahaprabhu a lot, but he couldn't figure out Nityananda Prabhu's. No. I mean, I can understand that. I can. Oh, you know, Nityananda Prabhu's an avadhut, you know, someone considerably eccentric. So it may take a few moments to, okay, figure out your new guest, so to say. Oh, I like Mahaprabhu, but I don't like Nityananda Prabhu. That's how the brother of Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says. So I accept one, but I cannot accept the other. Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, I cannot stay in this house one more minute. He left the house because this is Ardha Kukutti Nyaya. You cannot accept one and reject the other. By rejecting one, you are rejecting both. Like they are the half-hand logic, which means someone has a hand, making a business out of a hand, and thinking, okay, I'm feeding the hand, and the hand is giving me eggs. So there are two holes. One, I'm putting money. The other one is giving me money, eggs. So why better not only stay with the hole that gives me money? So better I cut the head of the hen, no more feeding, and just keep receiving eggs. But ABC biology and mathematics will teach you that the moment you cut the head or stop feeding the head, you stop receiving eggs. So you have both or none of them at all. So in the same way, not only Nityananda Mahaprabhu, but oh, I like Krishna unchanging, not ever evolving. Sorry, you're having half God and that's no God at all. Okay, I only want the ever evolving, nothing unchanging about him. That's not how it works. Oh, but it's so complex. Well, it's God. No, we cannot be like simplistic in trying to figure out the infinite. No? We have nothing against simplicity, but for me, simplicity is not the same as being simplistic. Simplicity for me means the proper integration of complexity. The result is simplicity. There is complexity, but it's properly integrated. Simplistic means I want to avoid the job of integrating complexity. Now let's make it simple. We are being lazy. So, yeah, Krishna is complex. Simple, but complex at the same time. Again, both. Like us, each one of us have all these polarities begging for integration. So let me read one paragraph or maybe two from the book in connection to what do we mean by saying that God is Krishna is on one side unchanging, changeless, but ever evolving, ever fresh, ever new. I'm going to page 14. It says, being made of love, God embodies a love that reaches everything. Not only his dedicated servants, humans, and all other beings, but all of existence. God is love. As the embodiment of love, he cannot help but love. Furthermore, he cannot but always seek to be more in love. That's the God we worship, one who seeks to be more in love at every given moment. He's in love, he's love, but he's in love with love, and not in a narcissistic way. No, I'm in love with love, and I happen to be love, so I'm in love with my, not in the usual, in that way. As the Srimad Bhagavatam declares, the goal of life, divine love, is directly, unceasingly, and unlimitedly increasing in God at every moment. I can give you the reference if you don't believe that the Bhagavatam says that, just okay. Yet we must consider a paradox. God is not only synonymous with ever-evolving love, he is, but also he is the ultimate object of that love. So God is love, Krishna is love, but he's the perfect object of love. This allows love to exist in others outside of him who love God and provide him the potential for ever-evolving loving interaction. So God's constitution, Krishna's constitution is love, but he's the perfect object of love, so some other people can have love for him. That allows for the possibility of loving each other, loving interaction. In other words, that Krishna's love is not enough for him. It's not like, okay, I'm love, so I don't need to interact, to relate to anyone. I'm love, and I can be self-satisfied, and he's self-satisfied. Here comes another paradox. Scriptures say Krishna is Atmaram, self-satisfied. He has good reasons to be self-satisfied. He's love. So I'm fine. I'm made of love. I don't need to go anywhere else. But the nature of love is always looking for more love. So love is not content just with remaining there, but to express itself in interaction. So that's why Krishna not only is known as Atmaram, self-satisfied, but Pararam, which means divinely dissatisfied. That's an interesting idea. Dissatisfied in the sense of, I want to love more. No. I'm love, I love, but I want to love more. There's an ongoing thirst for more love. So that makes Krishna engage in relationships with everything and everyone in love. So he's Atmaram, self-satisfied, and on top of that, he's divinely dissatisfied. And that takes him to engage in love. That's the beginning of the Rasa Lila. The Rasa dance in the Bhagavatam, the very first verse of the very first of the five chapters of Rasa Lila says Krishna is self-satisfied. And despite being self-satisfied, he was inclined to enjoy with the gopis and he played the flute. He felt satisfied. He could be, I don't need to play the flute, call the gopis, and just, I'm love. I can just sit with my love. But the nature of love is like, it looks for celebration, for expression. So that invites others. So Krishna is not calling the gopis out of lack, but out of fullness. It's not like Krishna is, I'm empty, I'm lacking something. No, he is so full that that needs expression and celebration. That's what we call lila. Lila is, it's like an expression of fullness. It's the celebration of fullness. And when the gopis go to Krishna again, they go out of fullness of love. They're not going in a codependent way. Krishna, we have this existential hole. We want you to fit in there and make me complete. I don't care for you. I want you just to complete my own hole here. No, no. They're both full and they get together to celebrate their mutual fullness in love. They're all made of love, Radha and Krishna. So. Sorry, I was supposed to be reading here. Wow. This generates a profound dimension of perpetual longing within the divine, as his infinite love reaches into new depths, ever new levels of theological intensity. So there is a perpetual longing in God, in Krishna, in the divine, to love more. There's no limit to that. It's difficult to imagine. And it's good that we reach those the limits of our imagination and we realize, wow, there is something on the other side of my wildest imagination. Because you can imagine as much as you can, but still it's in the limits of your own experience. So if we have not experienced a perpetual longing for love, our imaginations cannot grasp that. But at the same time, we can listen about that and feel, I'm feeling attracted to that prospect. I'm feeling called to that. It makes sense, despite that cannot, my imagination cannot reach that. My deeper self feels, yes, it must be that way. It's the only way reality makes sense. The ultimate goal of life is divine love, which grants us an absolute sense of ongoing, ever-deepening purpose. So purpose is, as we were talking these days about Viktor Frankl, he will make his logotherapy, which the goal of life is, he will say, not being happy necessarily. I mean, we have nothing against being happy, but sometimes you are not happy. Sometimes you are sad. And you cannot just press the happiness button and check, I'm happy now. So what do you do to with that happen? Find purpose in that. And when you are happy, find purpose in that. We are in whatever any other ex there's meaning and purpose. And so the goal of life, he will say, is purpose and meaning, not happiness. When you are able to find purpose and meaning, even in the worst situations, and he's realizing all this, having been a prisoner in the Holocaust, then you can draw meaning from anything. So love is the ultimate purpose of life, actually. In Sanskrit, artha, the word artha can refer to purpose, meaning purpose. And artha also can mean, refer to love, ultimately. So love is the ultimate purpose. When you learn to love, you can contact, access purpose and meaning at every moment, whether you're happy or not. That you love doesn't mean that you may be always laughing or happy. You may be suffering. You could be loving. Right. Again, paradox. Because sometimes we have a very comfort zone idea of love. Like love means always like laughing and enjoying and rolling on the ground in ecstasy, like consuming the product, like enjoying love. Oh, so loving, so love. I'm not denying something of that may be there, but beyond what we are imagining, it's always beyond. It also includes every other emotional expression. Rupa Goswami in Ujjval Nilamani, he will explain love in detail, and he will mention a whole array of emotional dispositions that also take place in love, like pain, like laughter, like fear, like envy. All this lust, greed, all this stuff that we are taught on day one, like that's bad stuff that you need to get rid of. At one point, you reach full circle and you find all that stuff in the spirit nourishing love. But that's how spacious love is, how much spaciousness love creates. It can accommodate every single emotion that at present we may feel is contradictory. It's opposite, it's bad. No, it's not. But you need to learn to love to give place to everything. So love can receive and accommodate everything. And we can have a glimpse of that even here and now. For example, again, loving and suffering, compassion. Compassion is loving and suffering. If you are suffering and I'm compassionate toward your suffering, I'm suffering with you. But that suffering, it's a loving suffering. It's expanding my heart, my consciousness. There is love, but there is suffering. It's a sweet suffering. Yeah. There's sweetness in suffering. It's possible. Again, as I like to say always, on a daily basis, Radha and Krishna in their Leela, it's not that all day is like laughing and joking. There's lots of that. There is suffering also. Serious suffering. In separation of each other. It's not like Krishna, rather like, great, we are separated. They are dying in separation from each other. They're suffering. Not in the way we think they are suffering. It's suffering fully in love, but it's their suffering. The invitation for us in eternity is to assist them in their suffering. Really. And be able to empathize with their suffering. Now, as we hear the service of the friends of Radha and Krishna, when they are dying in separation of each other, they need to empathize, to connect what they are feeling, to make the necessary arrangements to create the new union. If they don't have an empathic capacity for suffering, they see Krishna or Radha thrown on the floor, dying in separation. That, I don't know what's going on here. Why are you suffering? Come on, stop suffering. We are a spiritual world. We're not supposed to know. Nobody's saying that. They're all suffering together, but in a productive way. It's not like they get depressed and they get thrown there and they kill one another, they get suicidal. Nothing like that. Their love increases. That's what Krishna told the gopis when he disappeared from the Rasa Lila, right? I mean, in one sense, it makes no sense. Krishna is with the gopis, Radha, and they're dancing, singing, celebrating life, having the moment of their lives. Imagine yourself being, I don't know, here we're having a celebration, a party, celebrating, laughing, having a great moment. And suddenly, the main person of the celebration, the birthday boy or whatever, boom, disappears. What? At the height of the celebration, boom, disappears. It's like that makes no sense. So after Krishna returned to the Rasa Lila, in the midst of the gopis have a few questions to ask him, rightfully so. Among them is like, why you disappear from Rasa Lila? We were dancing, celebrating, expressing love for each other. It was a very genuine interaction of love. And there are many reasons, but the reason that Krishna gives, he says, paradoxically, he says, I disappeared. I left you because I love you. Paradox, I guess. Well, this is a very unique lover, right? With a very unique psychology. I love you so much that I disappeared. I left you. The usual thing it will be, if you love me, you will stay with me, not leave me. Say, no, I love you. And because I love you, Krishna says to the gopis, I want the best for you. If I really love you, I want the best for you. So what's the best for you? That your love increases. That's a real well-wisher. So I say, I want the best for you. I mean, I want that may your love increase. So Krishna said to the gopis, I love you. I want the best for you, which is may your love increase. And I could realize that that moment in Rasa Lila, the best way for your love to increase was for me to disappear and you to enter in love in separation. So I disappear for that purpose. So your heart will blossom in a very unique new way in separation. And now I'm back, and your heart has been upgraded to a new level. We can reunite and celebrate on a new level. And the gopis were like charmed by the explanation. It was like, wow, this Krishna is a very interesting guy. Because it makes sense. It's paradoxical. In the beginning, it makes no sense. Why you left? I left because I love you. Makes even less sense that you're saying that. But after he explains himself, it's like, okay, that makes sense in a very unique way. So those are the dynamics of love. Again, love is always in an ongoing search for a new version, a new level of it, a new expression. And sometimes for that, it has to hide, retire, whatever you may like to call it, to create a churning in the heart to blossom in a new way. So every time we may feel that Krishna has disappeared from my life, you may feel that sometimes. It's not that he's disappearing, he's just inviting you to a new level of intimacy. But as we say this day, we have to be careful not to be attached to find the same Krishna we find before, because now it's a new one. That's why when Krishna disappears from the Rasa Lila with this purpose that we just said, he reappears Sukadev Goswami describes Krishna's reappearance in Sakshan Manmata Manmataha. Krishna appeared directly as the Cupid of Cupids. We talked about that in our Navadvipa Parikram briefly when we went to the Madangopal temple. Sukadev Goswami said Krishna reappeared in a way that was more beautiful than anything we saw before, including Krishna himself. He appeared in a newly, ever more beautiful form. So that's the idea. Now in separation, okay, now he's more beautiful. And now he's more beautiful. It's a new person, in other words. So now the gopis are rediscovering Krishna, but it's no longer the older version, so to say. The one they met a few hours, moments ago when they were in Rasa Lila. He was already beautiful. He's all attractive. We are not trying here to downplay Krishna's beauty. He's always the all attractive. So they were dancing in Rasa Lila. He was the all attractive. He disappeared. And now he reappeared being even more beautiful. Sakshan Manmata Manmata than before. So now the gopis are rediscovering him after going through the dark night of the soul of separation. I'm finding Krishna more beautiful than before. But if they will be expecting Krishna to appear as he was before disappearing, they wouldn't find him because that version of Krishna is no longer there. Now he's more beautiful. So that's an important point. We shouldn't be attached to, how to say, not only previous ideas about God, but even previous experiences. That's a hard, heavy form of detachment. Because it's easy to say, okay, be detached from Coca-Cola or be detached from whatever, drinking alcohol or whatever. It may be even hard for some. But if I tell you, be detached from certain experiences you've had from God in the past, which are totally real and beautiful, I'm not saying reject them. I'm just saying don't become overtly attached to them because if not, you won't, they will prevent you from experiencing the newer version of the divine. You follow my point? It's like any relationship. Like you have, I don't know, a relationship with your wife, and you become overtly attached to the version of your wife during the honeymoon period. Right? It's easy to get attached to that because in that period everything is like all attractive. Huh? But then the honeymoon period is Gaur Hari Ball over. And you're invited to actually get to know your wife better. The honeymoon version was a little bit like superficial, like with all respect to the honeymoon period. Right? We all have honeymoons in Krishna consciousness and everything. Like, so it's great for what it is, but we know that's not the whole thing. So then you get to know, but if you get too attached, oh, I want you to remain being the honeymoon girl from that period, it's like, I'm who I am, and you're getting to know me. But if you are too much attached to that, you can never get to know the actual person. So, in the same way, we may have certain experiences of Krishna which are absolutely real, absolutely beautiful, and we can still remember them and be cherish them and the, how to say, develop hope and faith based on that, which is unforgettable, but yet we have to be careful not to be cherishing that so much that we are not giving place for any new experience of Krishna, as he likes to reveal himself to us today. December 11th, New Zealand time, just in case. Some of you may be seeing this and it's December 10th for you. So today, December 11th, Krishna wants to be someone for you. That is different from the version he wants to be for you on December the previous day, because he's always getting newer and newer, fresher and fresher, more and more beautiful. So how much we are allowing that to happen? We are allowing the other person to be all that they can be in relationship to us. And again, that goes beyond Krishna. It applies to any relationship. We are friends, brother, sister, husband, wife, whatever, son, children. And I'm not allowing you to be all that you can be today. And I insist that you remain being your yesterday's version or 20 years old version, honeymoon. But the other person will feel suffocated. Like, I cannot be myself. Well, you're not giving space for me to be me. So how much we are having a relationship, actually. So we can be doing that same thing to Krishna. And Krishna wants to be something else for us in love, offering himself lovingly to us. And we may be like, no, I don't like, I want you to remain being this old, predictable, controllable version of you. It's more comfortable. The newer is unsettling, unpredictable, invites me to grow, to change. I don't want to do that. Krishna is like, you are not getting it. Still, I love you, but you're not getting it, my dear. He's patient, if you can tell. Still, the heart waiting there, doing his best. So that's why we have to be careful about, again, acknowledging and loving whatever experiences of God we have, but not becoming addicted to them to the point that we can't have a new one. And that's what Father Richard Roll will say. That's a nice way to put it. He said, your previous experience of God is usually the greatest obstacle to your next experience of God. Say it again. Your previous experience of God is usually the greatest obstacle to the next experience of God. Does it make sense? Again, not to feel bad about the previous experience, not to dismiss it, downplay it, reject it. It's sacred. It's beautiful. It one builds up on the other. All of them are preserved, and we are ready for the next one. Sometimes I give the funny but tragic example. If I will tell my mom was so beautiful, the time we spent together when I was 5 months. No, you will change my diapers. So loving. Can we go back there? My mom will say, never. It was beautiful. We don't deny that. Nobody cancels that. But it will be dysfunctional to insist on that level of relationship. We are ready for more because that was beautiful. And so many other things were beautiful after that. All this build was building up, creating a momentum to the beauty that we can experience here now today. That's our best way of honoring all of those past experiences. Not trying to return to them and run back to them in toxic nostalgia and trying to bring the past to the present. No. That's not the way of honoring the past. We can only honor the past by living the present. And the present includes all that we can be, becoming, potential. That's why I like the description in the Bible when God speaks about himself. The definition is, he says, I am who I am. That's a very interesting way of presenting yourself. Like, who are you? I am who I am. Because even if you say your name, you say, I didn't ask which is your name. I ask, who are you? I am who I am. A very unique being, irrepeatable. I'm not who you are. I am who I am. Now, I'm not who I was. I am who I am. So it sets us in the here and now. And biblical scholars will say that actually, if you analyze the original, the tense in which that sentence is written is more like in future tense. So it says something like, I am becoming what I am becoming. Something like that. Like it's speaking in terms of potential. Like I am all that I can be. That's beautiful also. Because who we are all that we can be. We are plus potential. Who we are plus all that we can be. The same applies to Krishna. He's changeless, he's God, he is who he is, plus all that he can be in love. And there are unlimited possibilities in love. So all that we can be is unlimited. We have an unlimited prospect. Though complete at every moment, there is yet a need born from God's inner fullness to express itself in celebration of that fullness, which in turn leads to an ever fuller expression of himself to be celebrated. The dynamically perpetuating dance between fullness and celebration continuously draws out more God from God without cessation. The greater the love, the greater the need for more love, the fuller the heart, the more the urge to celebrate that fullness intensifies. Remaining still is no longer an option. That's why we worship a God who dances. Cannot just stay there. So much to celebrate. Love's fullness becomes its own force of movement. An endless dance drawing the sweet absolute into deeper, unceasing expressions of himself. See all the images here. They're all basically moving and dancing. You don't find any picture of Radha and Krishna, Gornitas. They're like nothing to celebrate, no reasons to move, static, changeless, like a monolithic, like a pillar. God. Yeah. No, so much to say, so much to celebrate. They are overflowing with the fullness of love, so you need to celebrate. No? No. That's why we worship it dancing God. No? Dancing is like ideal dancing, not like, okay, performative dancing, but natural dance. That's why in the scripture, dancing is one of the natural ecstatic symptoms, that you are so full with ecstasy that you cannot contain. And the body needs to express that fullness by moving. You cannot just sit and fill with ecstasy. If that's the case, you cannot sit still. No? So there are different types of movement. Of course, in this world, everyone is moving and running, but out of emptiness, trying to fill the void. Some other people have attained some form of peace, shanti, 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 and they're able to stop all movement. They can just sit still for eons. Yet some other people are so filled with divine love that they are no longer running out of emptiness, nor they can sit still. They have to move out of fullness. And that's why that's the invitation we are receiving, to a life of eternal celebration, dance. I mean, that's how Brahma Samhita described the spiritual world, right? Every step there is a dance. Every word there is a song. There's so much fullness, so much celebration that you cannot say they're walking. They're walking is dancing, they're talking is singing, because there is so much celebration, so much happening through the walking, through the casual talking. And Jiva Goswami, of course, comments on that verse in Brahma Samhita. If the walking is dancing, if the talking is singing, What must be the actual dancing and singing in that place? We need a new word to describe this. Because dancing is their walking. Singing is their talking. So what happens when they actually begin to dance and sing? You need to get there and find out about yourself. So, yeah. I'm saying that Rati Rupa makes some notes in Purvida. Let's go through some of them.
In the receipt is my bookmark. You can see how much money I spent.
I won't go there. How much you're willing to pay. Okay, let's go. Let's see some of the of her notes. Let's get to know Rati Rupa more through her, through what draws her attention. A reluctance to accept a changing God often reflects an aversion to unpredictability.
Very concise.
Good note. So yeah, that's one of the reasons why sometimes we may feel like unsettled with the idea of God in evolution and in movement, because it doesn't seem to offer safety and control and things in its place. He's changing, he's evolving, it's unpredictable. What will happen next? I don't like it. We felt insecure, unsafe. So that's why we, many times before talking excessively, God is always changing and moving and evolving, we need to settle the foundation. He's changeless. He's stable. He's love. So therefore, he loves you. That never changes. Find solace and stability there. And on the basis of that, there's movement, which is unpredictable. But the unpredictability happens in the perimeter of love, right? So as long as it's a loving unpredictability, it's okay. What we don't like is when unpredictability is not loving and there's danger and there's fear. We are not talking about that here. But yeah, it's good to know, to acknowledge the challenges of even talking about something so nice that God is ever evolving. Oh, that's unsettling. Okay, why? It sounds unpredictable. Yes, it is. What's the problem with unpredictability? And we need to, yeah, to go through the layers to see why, how can I be at peace with unpredictability, with things not going the way I want them to go. Things going out of control, of my control, not out of total control. Right? Remember, I always say, I remember once I saw this picture of a monk sitting in a rock in the middle of the lake, very Zen image. And there was a quote that said, "Relax, everything is out of control." Again, out of your control. It's not out of control, out of your control. But relax. But we generally think, I will relax only when everything is under my control. That will be the relaxation point. That will never happen. That's the exact formula for anxiety. It's trying to have everything under control. That's like, okay. So embracing unpredictability in a healthy way brings peace in a healthy way with trust on from where that's coming. Oh, that's a good one. Change becomes a flaw because sometimes people will think of God changes, that indicates that God was imperfect and he had to change to become perfect. Now, for some people will think God change implies previous flaw that requires a change. Now, what it says here says change becomes a flaw only when it signifies a movement toward the worse. Not when it embodies an ever-deepening revelation of divine excellence. So if someone changes for the better, there's no problem with change. When you change for the worse, that's a problem. So when we say God changes, it doesn't mean he becomes less of who we are or that he was less. It's just that he continues to expand and upgrade the perfection that he already is. Now, that's a point. One second.
One another question, Maharaj,
No,
or if
it's
you're
fine. It's
okay.
fine. I just move a little bit my. That's a section in this chapter that I address, which is God's perfection. We say, okay, God is perfect. Nobody denies that. So how someone who is perfect can evolve? So then comes, okay, we need to redefine what do we understand by perfection? Because many times by perfection we think a fixed maximum. You reach that, you are perfect. But there's no fixed maximum. You can be perfect and continue to be more and more perfect. That's one of the reasons why, in our tradition, numerically speaking, 100 represents perfection. And we say he's 100% in it. Okay, that means perfect, 100%. So, what's the number that generally represents God? 108. So, it's complete plus. No, it's fully and something else. And the eight, if you put it on the side, is the symbol of infinity. No? So it's 100, yeah, complete, perfect, plus infinity. Infinite becoming, infinite perfection. 108, that's total. Yeah. Two more quotes, and then we put the sharing to rest if you have any questions. And this all happens. Interesting, I never gave a class based on someone else's notes on my book. Ever fresh, ever new. So again, this happens, this 108, this further perfection of God happens, as we say before, because of the nature of love. We talked about love yesterday. Love is on the move. Love is growing and expanding. And I hear it says, God becomes what love requires. She likes the powerful
one.
one-liners. I'm starting to see that. Aphorisms, like four words, boom.
Can you repeat that, please?
Yes, she will repeat. She likes so much that she knows it now.
God becomes what we
What?
require,
What love?
what love requires.
Yeah. So God becomes what love requires. In other words, love has its own necessities. The necessities of love are to increase, to expand, to become more love. Love cannot be contained, as we say yesterday. Hai tu kiya pratihata. It's not like, okay, here we have love. I achieve love. I can rest now. You cannot rest once you achieve love. You start to move like never before. Like we say, to dance, to celebrate. A pratihata is uncontainable, it's uninterrupted. So love creates its own necessities in the form of further love. So, and that makes God to upgrade himself, if you want to. We are using words, so something we have to say, to honor that new necessity of love. So God becomes what love requires. So love is inviting us, and that's applied to us also. When we become all that we can be is based on what love is inviting us, a new level of invitation. And the last one is God is created, quote unquote, in love's image. Because generally we hear we are created in God's image. God is created in love's image. Again, God is not created, but a new version of it, a new degree, a new depth of the divine. It's manifest again, another way of saying because of the necessities of love, what love requires, what God becomes. So, yeah, a few thoughts. There's a lot to say about this. It's a whole chapter of the book that is called Can God Be Updated? Actually, that's the name of the chapter. And let me conclude with a quote, the initial quote, the epigraph, how I begin the chapter. Powerful quote by Ilia Delio, that I always try to acknowledge her inspiration as much as I can, because this book has been very much shaped by her writing and thinking and living. She's a, I will say, a contemporary mystic. She's a Franciscan nun. She's a scientist. She's a theologian and many more things. And she's a friend, elder of mine. I have the fortune of having met her, and she was very generous enough to write for an endorsement to the book as well. So I'm starting chapter two, this chapter on God, Can God Be Updated, with a quote by her. She writes a lot about the ever-evolvingness of the divine from her Christian perspective, but very open to other traditions as well, referring to Vedanta and so on in her writings. So she says, change is not contrary to God. Rather, change is integral to God. For God is love, and love is constantly transcending itself toward greater union. By change, I do not mean God becomes something other than God. Rather, God is a continuous becoming in love, driven by the absolute dynamism of divine love itself. Contrary to classical beliefs in God's immutability, like he cannot change at all, it is precisely because God is capable of change that he embodies absolute love and remains ever faithful in that love. We need three separate classes to unpack all that is in that quote, but it's a very condensed way what the chapter tries to speak about. Not denying the unchangingness of God on some level, but at the same time acknowledging we are dealing with someone that is growing and expanding, alive. Again, as absurd as it may sound, Krishna is alive. Yeah. Because many times we relate to God as an idea only, as a fixed idea in our head and not as a living person. That's what Saint Teresa, I think it was Saint Teresa of Lisieux, she will say, Christian mystic, prayer sometimes doesn't work for us because we pray as if God does not exist. Simple as that. We all day long speak about God, but how we relate into that reality many times is from a type of atheistic perspective. In other words, I say God exists, but I live as if he does not exist. I pray as if there's nobody on there. So how to be coherent and remain in touch with the living God, vibrant, ever-evolving God. Some ideas to share during this morning with all of you today. And we can leave a few moments if any of you have any thoughts, reflections, sharings, comments, ideally connected to what we have been sharing today. And in the evening, later today, we'll have more official space for further questions on any given topic. But maybe today in the mornings, we keep a little perimeter to, how to say, to go deeper into whatever topic we are talking. You raise your hand?
Yeah, I just
Yeah.
wanted to say about how we, Bashin Anand says, in this book, The Living Name, it's exactly that, right? We chant japa sometimes just as, as if most of the time Krishna is not present in the name, but he is
Exactly.
exi he's there. It's a living name. And so
Yeah.
exactly that principle.
Thank you. Yeah. And the name is no different from Krishna. So if we say the living name is the living Krishna, it's all living. But we have to be living to that which is already living. It's not that we treat Krishna as if not living, he's not living. No, he's continues to be alive, but we are sleeping, so to say. So it's us we have to enter into the living place and realize, oh, it was all living. Yeah, with the name, that's a very it's a very simple point, but it makes at least for me the whole difference, which is many times we chant the name of Krishna, calling Krishna. Like if Krishna is somewhere else, I'm calling him through the name. But Krishna is the name. So he's nowhere, he's not, I mean he's also somewhere else, he's everywhere. But he's also immediately in the name. So it's not that I say, Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna. Like, hey, you far away above the clouds, listen to his. I'm right. The very moment you say, Hare Krishna, he's there. That's the immediacy of his presence. But many times, as you say, we chant as if he's somewhere else, trying to call his attention. Look how nicely I'm chanting. I'm a good boy. Come to me, pay attention, like me a little bit. Come on, see, I'm trying to deserve to earn your attention. Why you're not coming? And he's already there. That's why we don't feel he's coming, because we expect him to. It's like you are here, and I look at the door, and I expect you. Why you're not coming? Why you will be coming? I said, I'm closer than what you think I am, but you have to just like, oh, you are there all the time, so. Same with the name, right? Krishna, come. You're not coming. And he's like, I'm so close to you that you're not seeing me. That's sometimes what happens. Krishna is so intimately close to us that we lost sight of him. Because many times we don't want someone so close to us. We are afraid of intimacy still. So if someone gets too close to us, we are not accustomed to that, so we lost sight of that person. We are just see expecting that people appears at a certain distance. So if someone comes a certain distance, I can acknowledge you. If you get too close, you stopped existing. I no longer see you. Where are you? Because we are not accustomed to think in terms of someone being closer to us than our very breath. But sometimes it's said of where God is. That's a whole different conversation, but it's related. How much we sometimes fear intimacy and why we fear intimacy, why we fear being seen, in this case by Krishna, in all our nakedness. We still fear that if he sees what I am, he will run away, I will be rejected, I will be condemned, I will be whatever. That's our own trip. But we fear that. So many times when Krishna wants to become more intimate, or some person from a genuine place wants to get closer to us. And again, it's understandable sometimes there's trauma related to intimacy, toxic intimacy, and we need to gradually heal from that and understand there is a healthy way of intimacy and being, and by intimacy, I don't mean just sexual intimacy, just intimacy in any relationship. And if we are scared of being seen, okay, when there is something to heal there. Because we are being seen all day long by Krishna in our nakedness, actually. It's not that we have to give him permission. He's seeing that. And he's loving us. Whatever he sees, he's loving that. So the problem is, what problem do I have with myself? Because he's seeing me naked and he loves that. But maybe what I'm seeing, what I think I am, and I'm seeing that I do not love that myself. That's what I may need to work on. Because from Krishna's side, the Acharya Bhat, Acharya Bhat, Acharya Bhat, that's what he says in the Gita. Soul says, you're amazing, amazing, amazing. That's what he has to say from his side. Anyhow, another conversation that's related.
I was going to ask, does God change in any other way than love?
For example,
Don't know. I'm just thinking if God is love,
yeah.
then that means the only way he can change is in love, because there's nothing other than love that is gone. So.
That's a good way to put it. But again, of course, that shouldn't be like, oh, he can only change in love. Like if love is just love. But if we understand what, in one sense, the ultimate love is the all in all, the most deep and comprehensive reality, and everything exists in the context of love. So when we say God can only change his love in love, the word only is not something diminishing in any way to God or to love, because love is the ultimate reality. So, and that reality is always growing and evolving. So there's, in other words, we cannot speak of God as being something other than love. Again, and that's not a limitation. When we learn to love, we will realize that saying God is love, God cannot be other than love. That's not a limitation. There is so much in there. That's what we want to become forever, also. We want to become units of loving dedication. I mean, when the soul becomes fully embraced by bhakti, no, Jiva Goswami uses the word tadatmya. Tadatmya means like sameness, or like a form of oneness without losing one's identity. So gives the example of the iron bar. You may have heard it, put into fire, and the iron bar becomes fire-like. Still, it's an iron bar, but it has all the properties of the fire. So for us, that's the invitation in bhakti. In the beginning, we come to bhakti iron-like. We feel heart is iron-like. Gradually, you expose yourself to the sacred fire of loving dedication in sustainable installments. Oh, a little fire, oof, it's burning. Okay, we take it out. A little more exposure. Okay, I'm getting familiar with the fire. I'm getting to like the fire. There's life, there is warm. We get to know each other. I think I can live eternally in this fire at one point. So, when the iron bar becomes fire-like, you cannot tell the difference. All the functions are there. So in one way, we become imbued with the influence, we will say, of Swarup Shakti or Bhakti and love. And we become, in our eternal identity, for all practical purposes, units of love. So that's all we are. We will be, and we can be all. Like, again, it's not like only that. What else is there? Once again, we have a glimpse of the nature of love. You realize that.
I think I was thinking of love as an emotion, but I was just reducing it to an emotion, but it's obviously far more, much more than that.
I would say that love is not an emotion. I mean, like we used to understand the word, because it sounds like, okay, and one more among many emotions in the spectrum. But as I was explaining before, and that's why Rupa Goswami, when he explains love, divine love, he explains every other emotion as being contained within love. So in one sense, love is kind of the ultimate vessel to hold reality, to hold emotions, to hold God, to hold ourselves. Look, sorry if I start to sound too poetic, but I have to when speaking about love. So love is the all of reality is held in the embrace and vessel of love. That's really what's going on. Everything, including Krishna, including the world of matter. Vedanta Sutra says, Loka Vatu Lila Kaivalyam. This whole Srishti Lila, material creation, comes as an expression of love, of God's love, God's heart. That's the definition of the word. I explained that in chapter 4. So this whole cosmos, from our perspective, is held by love, kept together by love. There are very interesting scientific findings from mystics and theologians also, that they will present all this scientific language in speaking about love, you know? Like how love holds everything together. Scientists will use other words, but ultimately, you can use the word love, and that's the force that keeps everything together. You may not use the word love in a scientific conference, but you can use so many other words to explain even material phenomena in terms of things that have been held together, sustained, and interconnected and interrelated. So, what's the glue that is keeping all that? So, yeah, it's not just that love is one option in the emotional market. But actually, all other emotions and everything that exists within the embrace, in the context of love. That's how I like to put it. Everything exists in the context of love. Well, without love, everything exists without context. Without love, we live a decontextualized life, basically. With love in place, everything is in context. Love gives context to reality, even to God's reality. Yeah. It comes to the point of having to say something about love, we have to resort to poetry. That's why I'm not apologizing for becoming poetic. I mean, I love it. But you have to. I mean, if you, at one point, we have to talk about love, and you kind of just keep it to device to another type of language. Yeah. Something else? Bhadra.
I this is going to be go off on too much of a tangent, doesn't it? It'll just be quick, but in connection with the really last experience of God is often the obstacle to the next experience of God. I'm just when you were talking about the Rasa-lila, something came to mind about when at some later time when the gopis went to visit Krishna in Dwarka at Kurukshetra actually, and they were not able to accept Dwarkadish Krishna. They only wanted Brajendranandan Sri Krishna. And so how do we reconcile that with, I mean, in one sense you answered it by saying God becomes love requires. But I just wanted a little bit of clarity on that.
Okay, that's a little bit of a parallel conversation to the topic. It's related. I can say something. May require a fuller lecture to go there. But so if I understood correctly, maybe your question is if God becomes what love requires, and but what how to understand what the gopis met with Krishna in Kurukshetra during the solar eclipse, and basically they are not willing to meet with him, I mean intimately, because they start to ask him, Where is your peacock feather? Where is your flute? You are riding on an elephant. Occasionally you show four arms. Who are you? If you are not, where is Vrindavan? Where is the Yamuna? Where are the cows? Where are you? Right? So yeah, here we are now. I mean, what I've talked so far is more, so to say, related to tattva vichar, like to ontological truths and the discernment considerations coming from that. Now we are more into rasa, lila vichar, like the dynamics happening in the lila and different flavors, different forms of the divine. So this particular lila speaks about how the gopis love a particular form of Krishna. It's kind of, this is how he likes the specificity of love, right? That I love Krishna, the gopis, I love Krishna, but they are especially inclined to a particular expression of Krishna. Sometimes I like to ask this question. If I ask someone, okay, what's the goal of life? And you tell me love for God, I say, that's too generic. Be specific. Okay. Love for Bhagavan. Which form of Bhagavan? Because you say love for the absolute, which absolute? Brahman, Paramatma, no, Bhagavan is the object of affection. Okay, which form of Bhagavan? Have Ram, Narayan, Krishna, unlimited. No, Krishna. Okay, which Krishna? Krishna in Dwarka, Krishna in Mathura, etc. Vrindavan. Oh, Krishna in Vrindavan. Okay, which type of love for Krishna in Vrindavan? Dasya, Vatsala, Madhura. I mean, I'm not saying that you just pick, like, if you're in the market, right? Okay, which type of Madhurya for Krishna? Are you looking for direct union or serving through, no? What Rupa Goswami will define, like looking sambhogechamai tat bhavichatmika, right? Like looking for direct romantic union or serving Sri Radha in her union. Oh, serving Sri Radha in her union. Okay, under the guidance of. No, my point with all this is like there's so much specificity. At that point, the idea of love for God is like a very generic abstraction. So, in the same way, the gopis have love for Krishna in a very specific way. So, whenever any other form of the divine appears, like Krishna in Kurukshetra, again, it's Veda, it's Krishna, but it's not Krishna. It's the same, it's Krishna, non-dual reality, the same non-dual absolute, but appear in a particular way. And the gopis cannot relate to that in terms of rasa. Again, it's not the necessary stage for the play to take place, for the divine play of lila, it's not there. So basically they express their inability to join with Krishna in that situation, because there are certain elements that need to be in place for loving union for that form. They're basically reclaiming Krishna of Vrindavan. And of course, we will say, in one sense, there are so many considerations. We will say Krishna never leaves Vrindavan. That's what Rupa Goswami says. Krishna never puts a step out of Vrindavan. So what about Krishna in Kurukshetra and Dwarka? That's expansions of Krishna. And that's what Akrura said. So, right? When Krishna and Balaram are on the chariot, Akrura is driving them to Mathura to meet with Kamsa and all that. The moment they arrive to the dividing line, they are about to officially leave Vrindavan. Krishna and Balaram say, wait, we need to take some bath here. So Akrura say, okay. And they take some time. Akrura say, they're not returning. So he goes and has this like epiphany that they show in like all this Aishwarya to Akrura. And the point with that, the Acharya says that with this, they mean from that line upward of Vrindavan, Krishna and Balaram going into their expansions. But they could return to Vrindavan in their original form. So we will say that Krishna continues to reciprocate lovingly with the gopis in separation. And in that separation, there is union. So they continue to find Krishna more attractive and more enchanting, and all these ever-evolving dynamics continue to take place between Krishna and the gopis while Krishna is outside of Vrindavan. And when the gopis go outside of Vrindavan, literally, And they found the expansion of Krishna outside of Vrindavan is not the same, because that's not their Ishtadev, basically. So, but at the same time, the point is when they find Krishna in Kurukshetra, finding him in that way and not being able to actually relate with the Krishna of Braj increases in them the love and the attraction for Krishna and Braj. So it's not that their attraction for Krishna and Braj stops. It continues to increase no matter what. So that's how it works. Right? Like even in Vrindavan, as we always give the example, if Krishna were to, how to say, behave a little unusually and show some Aishwarya in Vrindavan, when Krishna is in Vrindavan, the Brajavasis see him acting like an quote unquote ordinary boy, and they love him for who he is, not for him being God. But Krishna does sometimes a few things that are quite godlike, you know, like lifting Govardhan. That's Aishwaric. No? 7-year-old lifting such a big hill. You start to wonder, who is my child? Who is my friend? Who is my boyfriend? Who is my whatever? No? Depending on the relationship. But none of them, in the face of that Aishwarya, right, of that like majestic display of power, the only thing that happens in the heart of the Brajavasis is their love and intimacy grows. As we say, Jashoda, just think, you know, you must be so hungry by lifting this hill, I will feed you. His friend says, oh, you have missed, be tired of lifting the hill. You can pass the hill to Sridham that is stronger than you. He always defeats you in battle. Even they put Krishna down. Right? He's lifting the hill, and they say, you must be tired because you are weaker than him, than Sridham. And he said, no, I'm fine. So then they bring all the sticks. Okay, we'll help you. So their love and intimacy is never disturbed. It's just increasing. So the same, another case, but the same is with this. Gopis are seeing Krishna in Kurukshetra. They cannot relate to that. And the fact that they cannot relate to that makes them yearn even more intensely for their Krishna in Braj. And of course, Krishna exists to reciprocate with the love of his devotees. So there will be corresponding manifestation of Krishna to honor that newly increased love in the heart of the gopis at that moment. That's basically also one of the meanings of the Ratha Yatra, right? The Ratha Yatra Puri, in one sense, represents Kurukshetra. It can represent Dwarka, different readings. So Ratha Yatra means dragging Krishna from Kurukshetra back to Vrindavan. Gundicha represents Vrindavan. So it's a way of saying, okay, Krishna met with the gopis in Kurukshetra. The gopis couldn't relate to that, but their longing for Krishna in Vrindavan increased. But they were not in Vrindavan, they were in Kurukshetra. But somehow Krishna, Braja Krishna, manifested in their hearts to reciprocate with that longing that they are having. So externally they are crying in separation, they are not there in Kurukshetra, but internally there is this whole reciprocation going on between Krishna and the gopis. And Krishna is again the Krishna in Vrindavan is taken to Vrindavan, is dragged by that force. So one could even say the Krishna in anyhow, so many ways to talk about this. But the point is that it's not that in that situation the love of the gopis became like not ever evolving, became canceled. No, continues to increase because of the obstacle of having Krishna in an elephant without the, that's an obstacle. Having Krishna in a different mood and form. But the obstacle, and that's another part that I include in the book, quoting Prema Samput, that the symptom of real love is that whenever you put an obstacle in front of it, love increases. Right? Let's see if I find the exact quote, but it's basically that.
Sure, that's
Sorry?
we call it being in the
Oh,
first.
yeah, that's part one. Yeah, I was looking in part two. I was testing the reader. Yeah, basically that's the here it is. Jiva Goswami also says that in Pratisandarbha. He says, when opposing forces appear, love does not waver. Instead, it eclipses all opposition. When obstacles arise, love augments. Rupa Goswami describes love in Ujjvala Nilamani. He says, love is never diminishing, even when there are reasons for it to diminish. Like this, okay. There are reasons for the gopis' love to diminish. Krishna is in Kurukshetra, they cannot meet. But the nature of love is that it always increases. It never diminishes. That's why I like to say in this book, like lo true love has no opposite. It can only become more of what it already is. Cannot become its opposite. There's no opposite to true love. Can always grow into more. Bhishvanatha Chakravarti Thakur, I conclude with this. He says, another quote, if sufferings as vast as Mount Sumeru arise, whether from this world or the next, from others or from oneself, divine love, being incredibly strong, quickly conquers all these obstacles, growing stronger like a lion nourished, encouraged by the opposition of elephants. It's like a lion, right? A lion is walking, and an elephant appears in the way, like trying to attack the lion, obstacle. The lion would fight the elephant and feeds on the elephant. So not gain, it's gaining nourishment and strength through the obstacle. That's the analogy. So the same. The nature of the love of the Vrajavasis is it always grows. If you put an obstacle, it grows. If you don't put an obstacle, it grows. It doesn't matter. You do whatever you want. The nature of their love is to constantly increase. Krishna leaves a hill in front of you, Priti Aishwarik, love grows. You meet Krishna in Kurukshetra where no feather, peacock feather, anything, their love grows. Not for that form, but for their form. That's the unique psychology of the Vrajavasis. Like, no matter what's going on, their love keeps always increasing in their particular flavor of love. That means to really be in love with someone. You put opposition and obstacles and different other versions of this, and the longing comes more and more. Similar to the life of many saints, right? Like many of the Goswamis, they want to meet with Mahaprabhu, they want to go to live with him. Many of them couldn't do it immediately. Sanatana Goswami was put into jail. Raghunandhas Das Goswami tried to escape his home many times and he was brought back to his house. But ne none of that discouraged them. Like, oh, okay, then I won't meet Mahaprabhu. I can't plan cancel, mission cancel. That, their longing, the fire of their longing was increased even more. So the obstacles were increasing their longing. If real love is there, that will happen. If real love is not there, probably one gets, oh no, then I won't pursue that anymore. So that means it was not for real to begin with, so to say. Yeah. The next question for each one of us is, okay, where are we in all of this, internally, or we where we want to be? How can we, relate to all of this and somehow embrace and cultivate this wherever we are in a realistic way, in a relatable way. So,
Thank you. Thank you.
yeah, some thoughts. Thank you. Okay, we can put our sharing to rest and we can do one closing exercise. I like exercises. Some of you who have been with me on retreats know where I'm going. I'll put pause to the recording because this will be more it's simple exercises, more like sharing. We could make groups of three and two and share for a few minutes what I just said, like where I find myself in the midst of all that we have been talking today, what does resonate with me, how whatever we share today is speaking to me, and What do I feel inspired to commit, so to say, in relation to what is touching me right now? So I'll put pause to the recording, and then I will create some groups of two and three people to share in different parts of the house. If you agree with me. Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, ever-evolving love ki jai, ever-evolving Krishna ki jai, ever-evolving everything ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Priman ki jai.